You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President and the Director of the Foreign Policy Program here, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to today's very important workshop conference. This is a conference jointly hosted by our Center for East Asia Policy Studies and the John L. Thornton China Center, and I think could not be more timely given the heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula and in advance of President Trump's visit to the region in the coming month, in which the North Korea challenge will figure very prominently. And the purpose of today's debate is to inform effective strategy for dealing with North Korea, which is surely one of the toughest policy problems on the world stage today. This specific day is designed to generate insights onto two key questions, which are often left aside in the discussion. One, who is Kim Jong-un and what does he want? It's fine for us to debate the options to think about what we want, but any kind of serious strategy has to start with an understanding of who Kim is and what is he trying to accomplish. And second, what can we learn from past efforts to deal with this problem? This is not the first go-round of any set of strategies, and we want to make sure that we're learning as much as we can from what's been done in the past, both successes and failures of past efforts. We have an extraordinary lineup to explore these questions today. We're extremely pleased to welcome Everil Haines, former Deputy National Security Advisor, as our keynote, who will speak at lunch, who has been grappling not only with this challenge, but well aware of the complexities of American decision-making and how we try to think about this kind of problem. And we have a very deep bench of talent who have been thinking about this issue over a few decades, as well as in the near term. I'm going to turn the floor over to Ryan Haas in a moment to introduce the rest of the panel, but before I do that, I want to introduce two people who have recently joined what is now a very deep bench on Korea and Korean Peninsula talent here at Brookings. The first is Jung Park, who is our new SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies. She served for 8 years in the intel community, both at the CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and has an academic background studying American history at Hunter College. And is really one of the world's sort of foremost experts on the real dynamics of the Korean Peninsula. I'm delighted to have her here adding bench strength and leadership to our efforts on both South and North Korea. And Ryan Haas, who's over there, is the David Rubenstein Fellow in Foreign Policy. He just joined us. Prior to Brookings, he was a career Foreign Service officer and served in the Obama White House as the National Security Council Director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolian Affairs, so knows of what we speak when we think about the question of the Korean challenge and the Chinese angle to that. And these two will contribute enormously to our work. You will have noticed we also have a new president here at Brookings, John Allen, who, among other things, was the last military representative to the six-party talks the last time there were six-party talks with the Koreans. So just adding to our capability here at Brookings to try to offer insights and thoughts and constructive suggestions to those people inside the administration and outside and to our allies who are grappling with this extraordinarily thorny problem. And with that, let me turn it over to Ryan to introduce the panel.
Good morning. Thank you, Bruce. As Bruce mentioned, the first panel will concentrate on the question, who is Kim Jong-un? What motivates him? What worries him? We have an all-star panel to unpack these questions. Evan Osnos is a non-resident fellow in the Thornton China Center at Brookings and a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. He won the National Book Award for his book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in New China. He also captivated audiences recently with his latest dispatch from Pyongyang, The Risk of Nuclear War with North Korea. The second panelist is Jean H. Lee, who is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a veteran correspondent. In 2011, Ms. Lee became the first American reporter granted extensive access in North Korea. And in 2012, she opened AP's Pyongyang Bureau. She has since traveled often to North Korea and in the process developed deep expertise on what happens inside North Korea. We are pleased that she traveled from Seoul to be with us today. The third panelist is Jung Park, who Bruce has already introduced. I will just add that she's a good friend and a great colleague, and I'm delighted to be working with her. Each panelist will make 5 minutes of opening remarks. Following the opening session, there will be Q&A with the audience. And I would now like to invite the panelists to the stage, and we'll begin with Evan.
Thank you very much, Ryan, and thanks to Brookings, as ever, for putting together a terrific group today. We've got all our bases covered, and I'm going to be succinct because I'm much more interested in hearing what my fellow panelists have to say. Logistics explanation. I was in Pyongyang in August in my capacity as a writer for the New Yorker magazine, and some people have said, you know, how did you persuade the North Koreans to allow you to come and meet with government officials? And I said, well, actually, the more pertinent question is, how did I persuade my wife that this was an idea that was worth tolerating? And she's a person of heroic forbearance, and so I think I should mention that at every occasion. I'm going to make three observations about Kim Jong-un and the era of Kim Jong-un that I think might help us understand the world that he inhabits, or at least the world that he is trying to project. The first one is about the mythology of war. There is, after all, nothing new about the idea that the DPRK, or North Korea, presents a self-mythology about war and the significance of war in its narrative. This goes back for 70 years. But there are some important distinctions in the way that they talk about it now, really, in the 6 years since Kim Jong-un has come into office, that I think are at least worth noting. These are not differences of kind so much as perhaps differences of emphasis. The first one is that as a smaller and smaller share of the population has any personal experience or contact with the Korean War, he has to go that much further in order to remind everybody that it is essential part, that it is an essential part of their self-image and, more importantly, his self-image. He, after all, being the offspring of Kim Il-sung. And in their story, the United States, let's remember, the United States invaded, was driven from North Korea in humiliation under the visionary leadership of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung. And for that reason, he has inaugurated a larger, more lavish war museum in downtown Pyongyang. You see this when you go. And even if it was initiated under his father, he has made sure that he makes frequent visits. It's a big part of the propaganda message. And when you walk in, the first thing that you see is a statue, three stories tall, that looks exactly like Kim Jong-un, but is in fact Kim Il-sung. And if you make a point about that likeness, they are thrilled, because that's the point. So the other distinctive element of that mythology is that it is now, it's become inextricably intertwined with the notion of achieving the threshold that they perceive as having been reached in July, when they were able to fire an ICBM with the capability, at least in theory, of being able to hit the continental United States. That's their description, and they now mention it constantly. And you'll hear this more as other visitors go, and I promise you there will be more visitors. This is now part of a period where they're going to be doing that. And part of that, talking about that threshold, is that they now talk about the idea of a nuclear exchange in sort of casual ways, the idea that it's a survivable part of warfare, and it's an inevitable part of the continuum of the experience that they've had surviving Korean War and then also surviving famine and so on. A second observation that I made in Pyongyang is about the emphasis on economic development. And you saw this then repeated over the weekend in Kim Jong-un's comments to the Central Committee, in which he referred repeatedly to economic development, to the Byungjin line, the idea of parallel, simultaneous development of the nuclear program and the economy. This is also, incidentally, carefully chosen to tie him into his grandfather. His grandfather outlined the Byungjin line in 1962 to the Central Committee. So there is very much a connection between the way in which he talks about the economy and what he's trying to do, which is present himself as the inevitable and natural outgrowth of the heroic founder of the country. But you see this, all, if you go, you see these showpiece real estate developments. We've all read the same things, which is that at the higher floors there may not be electricity. But actually the truth is, you know, there is a fair amount of visible economic activity. And Jean will be able to speak to that more eloquently than I can. She's got this longitudinal perspective. But outside the official economy, you see a lot of economic activity as well. If you talk to defectors, as I've been doing recently, they will tell you about the new status symbols for the super rich. There's always been, obviously, a class system in North Korea, but there is now this very pronounced divide between the super rich and others. And the principal status symbol of the moment is a Yamaha piano. As I was told, it doesn't matter if you can play it. You have to have a piano. So that's also an indicator about the degree to which permeability of the sanctions regime. You are able to get things into the country. There's a lot of this sort of visible status symbols that people are showing off as they go about their lives. One of them is electricity. If you get your neighbors together in your building, you essentially form a little bargaining unit. And you go to the electrical substation and you say, we are a special building, and you give them a hand, you give them a bag of cash, and then you get much more reliable electricity transmission than others. A third observation about Kim Jong-un, and then I'll leave it after this, is his relationship to China, or at least the way that he talks about China or doesn't talk about China. It is quite notable that after 5 days in Pyongyang, the only subject that I was asked not to write about of my interactions with North Korean government officials, they said, just don't quote us on what we said about China. And I can be faithful to that agreement while also conveying the spirit of it. And the spirit of it was that they were very, very harsh. And they basically said that they regard China's approach to North Korea as essentially treating them like a pawn in this much larger dynamic with the United States. And so they are fundamentally distrustful of the idea that China has their best interests at heart. And you will hear other North Koreans have said to other American interlocutors that that China treats them like the dirt between their toes. That's the expression that you've heard from others, which is a long way from lips and teeth, after all, which was the original formulation that Chairman Mao liked to describe the relationship between North Korea and China. Just a couple of obvious points. Xi Jinping has not seen Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un has not received the North Korean ambassador, has not received the Chinese ambassador in Pyongyang, and there have been efforts to, you've seen that some of the North Korean weapons tests have been done on such a schedule that they embarrass the Chinese leadership. Most recently, the rocket launch last month that happened to coincide with Xi Jinping presiding over the opening of the BRICS summit. Whether or not this was, you know, deliberately designed for that day or not, there was clearly no effort to prevent it from happening. So I'll just in summary, I would say there's these three kinds of sort of political demonstration going on. One is about the mythology of war incorporating the new capability that they have demonstrated. Number two is about this commitment to economic pragmatism in some form or another, and at least permitting the elites to enjoy the benefits of economic development, pacifying them to some degree. And then the third would be the public and private effort to maintain independence from China, or at least to demonstrate, assert that they are willing to reject Chinese influence and control. And I'll leave it there. And thank you very much.
I want to thank Jung and Ryan for including me in this panel today. Please bear with me because it's just about my bedtime in Seoul. So do my best to stay alert and coherent. I'm not sure you planned specifically to have this panel on October 10th, but I just want to remind you that it is the Workers' Party anniversary, the foundation of the Workers' Party. It's not a milestone year, so we're not expecting massive parades or anything like that, but I just want to point out that it is exactly 7 years to the day that we first saw Kim Jong-un, that he made his first public appearance, not only to us in the outside world, actually I saw him the night before, but to the North Korean people as well. And I was there on Kim Il-sung Square, just standing on the plaza, when he did step forward and present himself to his people. And I could not help, and I'm sure you've all seen these pictures that the AP put out, the baby fat, you know, the chubby cheeks, and I just thought, God, I really hope this guy has a couple years of grooming because he's got a lot to take on. But it was really only 14 months later that his father passed away from a heart attack, and he had to really, he was thrust into that role as leader. And I mention his youth and his relative inexperience and also his relatively new appearance on the scene, because I do think that those factors inform the strategy in North Korea. And what I want to do is, because I've spent time in North Korea, and I think we have several sessions of some very smart people who are going to be talking about some of the other issues, U.S.-North Korea relations and the way forward, what I'd like to do is just present a couple points on the internal pressures inside North Korea, perhaps to try to help you understand the thinking on the part of Kim Jong-un, since this is about who is Kim Jong-un. So much of the country's ideology is pinned on this idea of a Kim in power. This is by design, but it also puts a lot of pressure on Kim Jong-un to make sure that he follows through with that role for decades to come. Now, one thing I did when I was in Pyongyang in May, my last trip was in May, was ask at the bookstore for some books about Kim Jong-un. This is a guy we know so very little about. So I did pick up two books. I will call them memoirs, but I will use air quotes because what I was looking for were some details to confirm the year that he was born. That has not ever been publicly disclosed, and I do believe the North Koreans will fudge that detail. And also a little bit about his childhood, because we speculate quite a bit about the influence that shaped him when he was educated in Switzerland. You know, how much influence did the West have on his thinking? None of that is in here. This is essentially a printed format of Kim Jong-un looking at things. But it does have a very interesting, when you open it up and you read the cover page, and I'll just read the quote in the cover page. "The revolutionary cause of Juche, pioneered on Mount Paektu, will be carried forward reliably by Comrade Kim Jong-un as the lineage of Mount Paektu." I say this with confidence, and this is a quote from Kim Jong-il, just to show you the kind of importance that they've put on having a Kim member at the top of this power hierarchy. And, you know, for him to have to carry that forward for decades to come as expected is part of the calculation that goes into their strategy, both domestic and external. So I will just mention a few points. Now, in order to maintain that sense of loyalty among the people, they have clearly gone to no expense at great cost to their people. We're talking about these bronze monuments that we're seeing, but it's not just that. It goes beyond that. It's nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. So much money is being poured into that. We need to remember that this is an impoverished country, and people are going without food, without electricity, without the basic necessities of life, because the regime has decided that they need to put the larger interest of the country's survival they need to make that a precedence, and that takes priority over. So they're looking at the longer game, and they're telling their people that without these things, without nuclear weapons, and without enforcing this sense of loyalty, we will not exist. Another point that I would like to make is just a couple things that Kim Jong-un is under pressure to do. He needs to justify his status, his power, his position, and part of the rockets are all part of that. They're also portrayed, I'd like to point out, as gifts to the leader. Every time they send a rocket or even test a nuclear device, they call it gifts to the leader. That touches on the sense of filial piety that Koreans are very familiar with. So part of the equation of understanding North Korea is understanding Korean culture as well. And that has been bred through thousands of years of Confucian background. It's just important to look at North Korea through that filter as well, and not just through this external filter that we're looking at from Washington. Staying in power. In order to stay in power, he's got to build loyalty among the people, among the elites, as Evan mentioned. This is a hard thing for a young man to do who had only been in the public eye for 14 months and also had not had the time to build those loyalty networks that you need to stay in power in a regime and a structure like this. So developing that court economy, making sure that you keep the elites happy, and also exacting punishment to those who do not follow your orders and exhibit any kind of opposition, right? So really maintaining strict control over the behavior of the people who are going to serve as your henchmen. So there's quite a lot of effort spent on maintaining and building the sense of loyalty in these networks. part of that also, and Evan talked about this in his New Yorker piece, building the loyalty of the next generations to come. You need the loyalty of the next generation, the youth and the children. One of the interesting things that you see in North Korea is, as we mentioned, I think that you may have mentioned the rockets and the kind of violent imagery that we see in kindergartens, in schools. And I was actually at dinner the other night with a friend who has a 2-year-old child, and he was distracting us because he was playing with a space shuttle that he had gotten recently here in Washington at the Aeronautics Museum. And it really occurred to me, so this kid is 2 years old. He can barely speak a full sentence, but he could tell me about every single part of that space shuttle, the boosters, and how it takes off and how it lands. And it just, I made the connection thinking, this is not that different. The North Koreans have picked up on a really smart strategy. Kids love space. They love space shuttles. They love rockets. They love devices. North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is also tapping into that. Children love this kind of technology, and he's building a sense of loyalty by giving them these kinds of tools and also taking it to a higher level, giving them computers, giving them the possibility of applying that technology and science to something that will carry them into the future and bring them some sense of political clout, which is programs and nuclear weapons and bombs and missiles that will bring some political clout to them within the Workers' Party. Now, he also has to show that he can defend the country. He's a young man, and in order to show that he can defend the country, he needs an outside threat. There is, frankly, nothing like an outside threat to bring a country together at a time when they are suffering from economic hardship. We see this in countries all over the world. Perhaps we're seeing a little bit of that in this country as well. North Korea and Kim Jong-un know the power of creating an outside threat. And so one of the things that I see with this escalation of rhetoric here in between Washington and Pyongyang is that that is just feeding the North Korean agenda. They actually need that rhetoric in order to justify and rationalize the continued development of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. And so that is one issue that I hope we'll hear people discuss in later panels, because that just serves to feed Kim Jong-un's agenda so that he can show his people that he can defend them. I do think that it's a counterproductive approach when it comes to North Korea. And the last point that Eva mentioned, building the economy. If you look at the most recent book that came out on Kim Jong-un, that is the most important point that comes through in terms of their policy objectives, is building the economy. And one thing I did notice when I was looking at the recent Bank of Korea economic figures, you know, we have so little understanding of how their economy works. They have not published data in decades. However, we can make some estimates based on customs figures and other types of figures coming from other countries. But what we do know is that their economy has grown. Nuclear weapons and the development of nuclear weapons, they've been good for the North Korean economy. And so this goes hand in hand when we talk about Byung-jin in this sort of parallel track. He's able to tell his people that by building nuclear weapons, we're also building the economy. It's about production. It's about manufacturing. So this is something to keep in mind as well. Now, I'm not going to go into any policy objectives because I'm hoping that we'll discuss that in later panels. But I would like for you to just keep in mind what the internal pressures are in North Korea. I think so much of our thinking is based on how North Korea is reacting to us in the outside world. But I do think Kim Jong-un has some internal pressures to deal with himself. He needs to stay in power. He needs to find a way to build the economy. He needs to build the loyalty of his people for decades to come. And some of these calculations tie into this incredibly well-crafted and savvily detailed strategy around nuclear weapons. Now, nuclear weapons, they call them their treasured sword. It started with Kim Il-sung. It started with two pistols with Kim Il-sung. And what he's trying to do, and it's absolutely true that he is trying to model himself and ride on the coattails of his illustrious grandfather, but with a very modern bent. So what he wants to say is, I'm just like my grandfather, but while my grandfather had two pistols, I've got however many numbers of nuclear weapons. I'm following in his footsteps, I'm following in his path, but in a much more modern way. He is banking everything on these nuclear weapons, and it's satisfying both domestic and external needs as well. And that's something that's important to look at and consider when we talk about a strategy going forward we need to take into account the domestic pressures that he faces and take into account whether he's going to be willing to give up the nuclear weapons or whether he's going to be what it is that we need to do in order to make sure that his sense of security and some of these other factors that he feels that he needs to take care of first at home are secure and stable so that he can think about interacting and engaging with the outside world in a constructive way. I wanted to just address a couple points that Evan mentioned in terms of, it's absolutely true that when they did build these high-rise apartments, there were a lot of grumbles from, even though these are very nice apartments and really sort of allocated both for not only the people who used to live in those areas, but for people who were given the apartments as a kind of perk. But there was some concern among the people that living on those higher floors would be problematic because the power does go out. I'm not sure how it was for you, but generally speaking, when I was living there, it was out by 10 p.m. And you'd be in the middle of dinner and all of a sudden the lights would go out. Very standard for us. I always carried a flashlight. I didn't even interrupt my conversation, just turned it on. Very much a part of daily life in North Korea. That said, I did hear some concerns about what will happen when the power goes out and you're living on the 25th floor. An interesting point. I am right now analyzing North Korean dramas, the dramas that are being released in the Kim Jong-un era, and I'll be presenting the findings from that next month at KEI. But it's interesting because in their daily dramas, in their soap operas, they've incorporated this concern. So in one of the dramas I'm looking at, this concern about power outages and how you're going to get to your 21st floor apartment is part of the drama. So it's always interesting to look as well at the North Koreans' own state media and their own entertainment to try to figure out how they address some of these concerns just on a ground level in terms of how do they tell the people and how do they acknowledge it. So it's fascinating stuff, and I hope you'll join me there if you're curious to see how some of this policy is being conveyed through North Korea's own soap operas. And I think I wanted to mention also, you were talking about, status symbols. Absolutely. And then that goes back to the point I was making about the court economy, keeping the elites happy. I wanted to make one more point. Koreans are a very conformist people generally. Their cultural tradition is very much a conformist one. And the North Koreans are very similar. So they want to do what the group does, generally speaking. And so anytime we try to suggest that there might be some sort of Arab Spring in North Korea, that just doesn't fit into the North Korean thinking, or the Korean thinking for that matter. Even when, for example, in South Korea, people protest, they wage an opposition, it is very much a part of a group dynamic. There is a group sense of solidarity in any kind of anything they do, whether it's opposition or maintaining the status quo. And that is true in North Korea as well. And so it's just something to keep in mind, to remember that they have their own cultures and traditions and history, and that we may look at it from our perspective, but we also need to take their culture, their history into account in trying to decipher their thinking. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Evan. It's my pleasure to be up here with you. I'm a big fan of your writings. As Bruce mentioned, I was trained as a historian, as a U.S. historian, so I'll start with this quote. Andrew Carnegie, the American industrialist and philanthropist, once famously said, "It is but three generations from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves." Or in other words, the first generation makes the money, the second generation keeps the money, and the third squanders the money. Kim Jong-un seems determined to avoid that fate. Since his father Kim Jong-il's death in December 2011, Kim 3.0 has not only adopted the mantle of mythical godlike leadership role that his father and grandfather held and continue to hold in their death, but seems determined to chart his own path. In short, this is not your grandfather's dictatorship. It's useful and important to know the history of negotiations with North Korea and what we know of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il through observations of their actions and face-to-face interactions with the U.S., South Korea, Japan, Russia, and Chinese officials. But I think we would be remiss if we extrapolate Kim Jong-un's intentions and foreign policy preferences as if he and North Korea exist in an ahistorical space that is unchanging and unevolved. Let's consider the similarities first. The Kim family created and reinforced a cult of personality around each Kim. The regime is totalitarian, controlling the populace through fear and intimidation, ensuring loyalty through repression, rhetoric, and rent. North Korea has been the shrimpiest of the shrimps among whales, hemmed in by larger neighbors, including a rising South Korea, and the memory of devastation wrought by the United States during the Korean War. The similarities end there. Kim Il-sung was a revolutionary hero, fighting Japanese imperialism, the South Korean puppets, and the American jackals. Kim Jong-il had to navigate through world-changing events, such as the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of large-scale aid from Moscow. The ever-suspicious Chinese, who seemed to be prioritizing their ties with Seoul, and tense negotiations with the United States on its burgeoning nuclear program. And let's not forget the famine and the drought of the 1990s and the tightening noose of sanctions and international ostracism. In contrast, Kim Jong-un grew up in a cocoon of indulgence and privilege. He continues to choose isolation, refusing to engage, doubling down on the commitment to nuclear weapons, working toward improving conventional military capabilities, expanding the North's toolkit of provocations to include cyber attacks and the use of chemical and biological weapons, and rebuffing every engagement effort by the U.S., China, and South Korea. He doesn't even bother to pay lip service to denuclearization, as his father and grandfather often did. During the arduous march, the famine of the 1990s, Kim was in Switzerland. His childhood was marked by luxury and leisure, vast estates with horses, swimming pools, bowling alleys, luxury vehicles adapted so that he could drive when he was 7, summers at the family's private resort. He went skiing in the Swiss Alps and swimming in the French Riviera. His strong self-esteem and confidence was reinforced since he was young. His aunt said that on his 8th birthday party, Kim wore a general's uniform with stars, and the real generals with real stars bowed to him and paid their respects to the boy. I don't know about the real stars part, but Kim's charting of his own path can be seen in the way that he shaped his public persona. He's determined to be a modern leader of a modern North Korea. Unlike his father, Kim is more transparent. He is in public with his wife. He's hugging, holding hands, linking arms with men, women, and children, young and old. And for the first time in April 2012, the regime also admitted publicly that its satellite launch had failed. He's out and about giving on-the-spot guidances like his father and grandfather did, but he's also pulling weeds, riding roller coasters, and horseback riding. He is comfortable with technology, handling cell phones and laptops, and talking earnestly with nuclear scientists and overseeing scores of missile tests. Lest we have any doubt, Kim is young, vigorous, virile, and on the move. Kim Jong-un's confidence can be seen as Pyongyang policy that North Korea can have both its nuclear weapons and economic development. North Korea's status, the nuclear status, was codified in the North's constitution, even as Kim boldly claimed no more belt tightening. Kim's very identity is tied to the nuclear program and North Korea's prosperity. Of note, Kim, like others in his generation, have never known a non-nuclear North Korea. For the past 6 years, Kim has poked and prodded, testing and pushing the boundaries of international tolerance for his actions, calculating that he can handle whatever punishment is meted out. And to a larger extent, he has maintained the initiative on the Korean Peninsula to the frustration of the U.S. and his neighbors. However, he has yet to face a real crisis in the ways that his father and grandfather had to confront and manage. Kim's probable perception of success in international affairs, reliance on military demonstrations and provocative actions to get his way, without any experience in negotiating, compromising, and diplomacy, makes me wonder how much longer we can say with any level of comfort that Kim's nuclear weapons are only intended for deterrence and regime survival. And given the steady drumbeat of internal purges, the sidelining of North Korea's diplomats since 2011, and Kim's apparent relishing of the recent war of words with President Trump, it would take a very brave North Korean official who would counsel dialogue and efforts to mollify Washington and Beijing. In 2012, at the 100th anniversary of his grandfather's birth, during what was then North Korea's biggest display of weapons in a military parade, Kim gave his first public speech. He ended with the line, "Let's go on for our final victory." At the time, it sounded to me like the bluster of a new, young leader. He may have been posturing then, for all we know, but given recent developments, I hope that he hasn't shifted his position to a more aspirational and offensive one. Thank you.
Evan, Jean Jung, thank you for the excellent presentations. The floor is now open to you. We have about 20 minutes for questions and answers. And while you formulate your questions, I will just make one quick observation about the three presentations we just heard. There was an emphasis on the internal threats and stresses that Kim Jong-un faces, very little discussion of the external pressures that Kim Jong-un feels, which I found noteworthy. Does anyone have any questions, comments, feedback? A microphone will be coming to you. We'll take two or three questions at a time and then offer the panelists an opportunity to respond.
Will Satron, I'm with the Institute for China America Study. So my question is for Ms. Lee. You talked a little bit about elites, and we obviously know very little about the North Korean regime, the leadership, how it works. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those elites that we know so little bit about. Thank you.
Why don't we take one or two more questions, and then we'll allow the panelists the opportunity to respond. Yes.
All right. Hi, I'm Patrick McEachern with the Wilson Center. It's nice to see you all. My question is for Jung. How do you think Kim Jong-un sees the inter-Korean competition and unification issues? Is this something that's still alive and well and an important pressure within the regime?
Thank you. Sir.
Steve Winters, independent consultant. The leading Russian expert on North Korea and others have suggested that one of the purposes of the nuclear weapons program of North Korea is also to guarantee Korean independence in regard to China, and that ultimately it's a defense in that direction too. So, but I'm curious, was there any hint of that line of thinking among the people in North Korea?
Thank you. Why don't we take a pause here, allow our panelists a chance to respond.
I'm not sure if you had a specific question about the elites, about who they are, or perhaps clarify.
Yeah, the question was more in general who they are, because with the countries like Russia and China, you know a little bit about who the leadership is beholden to, who they're basically have to pander to. But I feel with North Korea, it's such a closed state that you don't really understand the dynamic of what they have to do, what Kim has to do to place to solidify his hold on power. And I feel like that's an important dynamic.
So I'm just going to approach this from another angle. One of the things that I found spending so much time there is that their structure, their societal structure, is so different from ours. So, for example, when we make decisions every day, it comes from our family. Your parents make some decisions about what you're going to do that day, how you're going to spend their money. In North Korea, it was completely different. With my staff, for example, the party was the determining factor. So much of their lives are built around the party structure, political structure, and that is the defining structure that tells them what they're going to do on a day-to-day basis. It tells them whether they're going to eat at a certain restaurant, whether they're going to be able to go to the Arirang Mass Games. And this was new for me, but it was important to remember. Within that structure, then, in order to reach that level of elite, you had to have a certain amount of political clout. So much of the effort that I saw on the ground in North Korea was to build political clout. And I mentioned that a little bit earlier in my comments. So, for example, when I met a farmer, when we were hearing these rumors about economic reform or changes to the economic structure, and they were saying, finally, if they make a little bit more extra rice, she was a rice farmer, they would be able to use that surplus for themselves rather than hand it over to the state, as was the case. So when I asked her, though, what are you going to do with that extra rice, she said, I'm going to offer it to the party as a political offering. It was very insightful for me. That's so important. That's so much a part of their structure. When you have political clout, then you get a better apartment. So I did visit homes in North Korea that were granted to people for their loyalty to the party. So just in terms of how we look at who becomes part of the elite, of course, we're looking at things from our point of view as a capitalist country, but for them, it's all about who has political clout. And there are certainly other factors we do talk about. Certainly after the liberation and the Korean War, there were different structures that were put in place to kind of codify North Koreans in their background. But today, most of it is about that kind of trying to build political clout and to rise out of your situation by showing your loyalty to the party and, in that sense, improving your sense of life. So that's one part of the question you're asking. I think the other part you were asking is how do they keep them happy? I mean, it's like Evan mentioned, wanting a Yamaha. I can tell you that when I go into the certain cafes in North Korea, I forget that I'm in North Korea. And it's terrible. We always have to remember that we're there. But they are just as sophisticated and international as South Koreans. With the latest, you know, most North Koreans, when I was there in May, the North Koreans I was traveling with each had two cell phones, just like I do. So we were joking. You know, I was just amazed by that, right? So in some sense, they are, go ahead and weigh in.
Yeah, I was very briefly, just a couple of things. I mean, there is, in some sense, you know, North Korean elites in Pyongyang, and we really need to, you know, be clear, we're talking about a pretty small, but not insignificant percentage of the population. If Pyongyang represents 10% of the national population, these are the 10% that matter, in a sense, in terms of pressure on Kim Jong-un. You know, there are people in Pyongyang who make a point of speaking with a South Korean accent as a way of indicating that they're cosmopolitan, they're sort of plugged in, they're watching, wink, wink, TV and film. That's and true. So on. People get cosmetic surgery. So, you know, I think, in a sense, the risk for Kim Jong-un from his internal pressures is as much about the revolution and rising expectations. And you hear about this a lot. The possibility that the fact that he's done this means that if he's going to maintain those, you know, avoid the fate that Jung so rightly described of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, he now has to be able to deliver to the people around him.
He's got to give them the creature comforts that they are experiencing when they travel overseas. And quite a number of them do. I think you said your plane was not very full, but most of the Air Koryo flights I took were packed with North Koreans who were traveling to via China or to China. And so those people, each plane load, how many people is that, are getting exposed to the outside world, picking up cell phones. Like me, until 2013, they had to check them in at the airport. But developing a taste for some of those creature comforts. And so he has to give those to the elites as well.
Could I point out that elites, it's historical and it's also monetized. The elites were a small group that live in Pyongyang, descended from the people, the revolutionaries who went through the mountains, forded the rivers with Kim Il Sung. But then there's that tension with the moneymakers that Evan and Jean are talking about, and I see Nat Crutchin in the back, and he knows as much about this as anyone I know. In terms of the, you know, those the moneymakers, the people who are becoming elite rather than being born elite, that these are some of the tensions that we could, as a policy measure, could take advantage of with the sanctions. So I think, you know, the term elite is changing, and I think that could be the beginnings of some of the fissures that we could exploit. On the question on Kim and inter-Korean, hi Patrick, on inter-Korean competition. What Jean and Evan are pointing out in terms of the coffee shops and the Korean TV shows and the dramas and the creature comforts of life in North Korea, I think those are directly from South Korea. South Korea is whether they like it or not, are influencing the way they describe or they define what is middle class or upper middle class. But on the other hand, they're holding on to the idea of being the purest or the purer Korean race, that because they're not flunkies to the United States, that they still maintain this this mythical Koreanness that's a result of their isolation and something that they will defend and defend with their nuclear weapons. On the independence from China question, I think you were saying that the nuclear test and the rocket launches, I think that is their declaration of independence. The nuclear weapons program was started not just against the U.S., but also to hedge against China. So I think, you know, and I'm thinking about the fact that Kim Jong-un has not talked to senior Chinese officials at all. And I think it's his way of saying, I'm my own man. I'm crafting my own path without you because I don't need you. So I do think that there is a strong, you know, independence from China angle to the story.
Excellent. Thank you. Why don't we open it up for another round of questions? Stanley?
Stanley Roth, retired. Given that this is a panel about who is Kim Jong-un, could you speculate, all of you who want to, about who is Kim Jong-un if he succeeds with his weapon programs, if all the current policies fail and he has a reliable ICBM nuclear tip capability against the United States, then which Kim do we see? Is this going to be a stable Kim, one who's accomplished his objective and can now focus on the economy? And this can be a traditional deterrence situation. After all, we keep hearing he's not suicidal. Or could this be a destabilizing situation, that he doesn't believe in extended deterrence and that Kim now feels he has delinked the ROK in Japan from the United States because of his capabilities and might risk action, confident that the U.S. won't intervene? Do we have, I realize it's all speculative, but based on what you've told us about his character, which Kim do you think we would see in a success scenario?
I'll take a first cut at it. I think we're going to have a lot of views on it. But one thought is a couple of things. You mentioned the fact that he's not suicidal. I think that's a big point, and it's one worth emphasizing. You know, one of the things that Gene and Jung both described was him growing up in this cloistered, prosperous, plush, easy environment. One of the few reliable face-to-face descriptions we ever get of Kim Jong-un comes from, let's face it, Dennis Rodman. And what does Rodman describe? He describes a person who enjoys the fruits of his experience at the top. So I think, you know, we live in a moment now where we are almost getting acculturated to the idea that there is the jihadist impulse, the idea that you are going to die in service of some greater ideology. And I think it's important to remember, what is Kim Jong-un's primary motivation in life seems to be the benefit of Kim Jong-un and his experience. What that doesn't mean, though, however, is that he's not capable of profound miscalculation. And the same level of seclusion and privilege that has also afforded him the non-suicidal impulse also means that he is really hasn't really been steeled in the kinds of mistakes, and he hasn't been tested in the ways that would prevent him from making a catastrophic error. And so, you know, as you knew when you asked this question, we're not going to have a firm answer, but what we can do is lay out some of the probabilities. And I think the probabilities are that fundamentally, he's going to try to do the thing that keeps Kim Jong-un alive.
Just to build on that, we haven't really discussed it in this panel, and I think we'll probably discuss it in future panels, but completion of reaching the threshold and reaching the next step, which is reentry and also miniaturization and getting it on a missile that's capable of striking the United States, this is just one part of the equation. The next step, obviously, there's a domestic benefit to having these weapons and showing your people you can defend them, but there's also that external purpose, which we haven't really discussed, which is to get the U.S. to the negotiating table. I know, as strange as that sounds, and to get the validation that he wants. Because another thing that he needs is validation from the United States. He wants the United States to acknowledge North Korea as a nuclear state, as a nuclear power. and to be able to go back to his people and say, look, I'm just as they're treating me like we're a tiny country. We may be poor, we may be small, but the U.S. is treating us like a fellow superpower. So that's part of the equation. So I think there are several steps involved here in terms of what he wants to do with this nuclear program. And then from there, what does he extract? What kind of concessions or what does he do with, what does he negotiate with these nuclear weapons? So I think this is just the start of it. I don't think it's meant to destruction and completely annihilate the Korean Peninsula, at least I hope not because I live there. I think it's all meant as part of a larger strategy to win the things that his grandfather died not succeeding to accomplish and his father died not accomplishing. So these are part of the things that he's inherited and the pressures that he still faces in trying to fulfill that legacy.
Thank you. Jung, do you want to come in on this?
Just very briefly, I remember when I was briefing one of the senior DNI officials who had just entered office. This was back in 2014. And he went around the room and he made everybody say, how long do you think this regime is going to last? Somebody said, one of the senior analysts said, 5 years max. And then I was next and I said, well, he's got children. At the time, he had one child, but now he has multiple children. So so I think that you know, in looking at the long haul, it's not just about him, but he's probably also thinking about his people, his kids, his family. I would just add that I think if he succeeds, I think he finally gets that respect. I think the reason he hasn't traveled anywhere is because he doesn't think he's going to get the red carpet treatment, and it would be really embarrassing for him. So I think having the nuclear weapons status, it for him, is about respect, and it's about relevance, because otherwise you're just another poor country in Asia.
Thank you. We have time for one more round of questions. In the back.
Yang Lo Yun, Foundation for Empowerment. I'm all late, so I missed a lot of the presentation, but I'm sorry about that. But from what you have been saying and the Kim Jong-un's policy, so I'd like to ask about the Kim Jong-un's policy, which enables people, particularly elites in Pyongyang, to enjoy the sort of like a Western style of the life, amusement park and other things you have. And then you are talking about the sophistication. Then what kind of impact it would have on their own psychology first for the elites? The one, good part or a very strong part of the Kim Jong-un's policy or Kim's family's regime's policy is purity of their Koreanness, and their basic mission, if I understand it correctly, is to liberate South Koreans from the Yankees. Then, you know, with this kind of thing, their mindset is corrupt, first. Second, they are so much, 90% outside Pyongyang. If they know about lifestyle of the Pyongyang elites, what would they think about their own situation and where is the dignified North Korea? So many foreign reporters have been talking about the dignity. They really, North Koreans feel that they have more dignity than the, anybody else. That really keeps them up. So what kind of the corrupt impact would have on this common people's mind? So people say that one of the most strongest policy would be to inject the information so that, you know, USB of the outside information would be the most powerful tool to liberate North Korean mind. So basically, in summary, my question is, this Kim Jong-un's new policy, what kind of impact it has on elite's mind and the inequality between elites and the others? And can it hold up that kind of the mission? Thank you very much.
Why don't we take one or two more questions?
Hi, Catherine Kilo, Plowshares Fund. I'd like to hear your thoughts on Kim Jong-un's recent promotion of his sister. What exactly will her new role entail, and is the timing of her promotion significant to you at all?
Thank you. Final question here.
Hi, Patricia Kim with the Council on Foreign Relations. As all of you have mentioned, there is now this generation of super rich in North Korea, and this has made people both loyal to the regime as well as creating vulnerabilities for the regime. But I think this is in tension with the conventional wisdom today that economic sanctions aren't going to do much to persuade the North Korean regime to denuclearize. So how do you address that tension? Is the regime vulnerable or not, and at what point does it become vulnerable? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody want to take one of these? Okay. I mean, I'll take a stab at a couple of these. The first question, which was about the mindset of elites. I mean, I think we talked a little bit about what sort of the mindset is at the moment, but I want to take the question, if I can, in a slightly different direction, which was, how is Kim Jong-un regarded by his people, which is also a relevant question. I mean, to what degree are people in the countryside, for instance, aware of the lifestyle of the donju, the super rich living in the capital? I think one of the things you get from defectors is the sense that people are responsive to these lifestyle improvements. So if you're in the city, it's at the top end. If you're in the countryside, the ability to go to a market or to work in a market does have some effect on people's view of Kim Jong-un. So he may not be as unpopular as we might assume. On the other hand, people also look at him and see, as Gene described, a young man who did not rise up through the ranks of the guerrillas. He didn't establish himself as a revolutionary hero, and so in some sense he has to prove himself. I think I'll probably, I want to leave time for the others, so I'm going to cut it off there.
On the elite question, the poorer people in the provinces were looking at the lifestyles of the rich and famous in Pyongyang. I think, I'll go back to what I said about Andrew Carnegie. Back in the late 19th century during industrialization, the question for labor historians is not why there were so many protests, but why weren't there so many protests? Why weren't children who were at age 10 and 11 working in the coal mines, why weren't their parents protesting out in the street? And I think, to a certain extent, you can transfer that kind of analysis to aspiration, lifting yourself up by your bootstraps. The Horatio Alger story of the late 19th century and the early 20th century that was so popular is that somehow if you work hard, if you know the right people, and if you can, if you lift yourself up, then you too can be there with the lifestyles of the rich and famous in Pyongyang. So I think hope is a little bit, plays some part in the process of keeping the outside populations in the provinces mollified. Also, in looking at, Jean was talking about her book of Kim Jong-un looking at things. He's looking at things, but he's also hugging people. He's interested in what people are doing, which is exactly what Kim Il-sung did in the 50s and 60s. He was out there. He was out there with the peasants. Kim Jong-un is pulling weeds. He's talking about turtle farming. So while you have this vast wealth gap that Jean and Evan and others have described, you still have the Kim Jong-un being out there with the people, cultivating hope in a lot of ways, and strengthening the resilience of the regime. I think there was another thing about the sister promotion question. So the way I saw that meeting and the elevation of his sister and the promotion of his sister is not that the analysis that yes, he's solidifying his rule, he's doing the sister is a very critical part of his regime building and his legacy. The way I saw it was that if you're having a party meeting and you're promoting the rocket guys and the deputy director of the light industries that works on textiles, that tells me that maybe somehow the North Koreans have moved on past this this period of tension, that they're back to business. They're doing their promotions. They're in it for the long haul. And they're also talking about the economy. The speech that Kim gave was very much about the economy as much as it was about the weapons. So I will stop there, I think, unless others had comments.
Furthermore, I think going just building on the sister's promotion, all of this does also emphasize again the importance of the Kim family as part of the ruling, ideology. And it is one thing that I note in my Esquire piece that I wrote this summer was that Kim Jong-un did revise the guiding principles on political life in North Korea to make sure that it includes a reference to a Kim member being in power. So part of this is, you allude to that. But I think on a more basic level, it is a tradition within the Kim family to have another Kim family member do all of your deification. So Kim Jong-il did that for Kim Il-sung. Kim Jong-un is doing that right now for Kim Jong-il, which is what we saw this past weekend with the fireworks and all this big celebration for his father's 20-year promotion anniversary to the Workers' Party secretary position. And we'll likely see Kim Yo-jung, the sister, doing that as well for her big brother. So it's just part of some of these roles that she's stepping into are roles that members of her family have played in that succession, in that kind of history of how to deify the Kim family.
Thank you. We started out this hour with the question of who is Kim Jong-un, what animates him, what causes him fear. I would like to just end with a few observations that I took away, at least, from the presentations that we just heard. First, it appears evident that Kim Jong-un is focused on preservation of power and continuity of the Kim family rule. He faces pressures internally to deliver on the needs and wants of the North Korean people, particularly the elite. Heightened rhetoric directed at North Korea helps and abets Kim Jong-un in feeding the mythology of confrontation that supports and justifies his rule. And internal stresses and pressures appear to be front of mind for Kim Jong-un on a daily basis. So with that, let me just express my profound appreciation to these three great thinkers for advancing our understanding of the question of who is Kim Jong-un. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to just briefly introduce the panel. This panel is on historical lessons or case studies that can inform our views about how to solve the North Korea problem. First up is Jonathan Pollack. He's the senior fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center and the Center for East Asia Policy at the Brookings Institution and one of my favorite colleagues at Brookings. We have Michael Dobbs, author of the Cold War Trilogy, who is uniquely qualified to tell the story of the defining ideological contest of the 20th century. Jake Sullivan is the Martin R. Flug visiting lecturer in law at Yale Law School. Nate served in the Obama administration as the National Security Advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and Director of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State. And finally, David Cohen, my former boss, who's a partner at WilmerHale, was the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. While he helped to manage the agency's domestic and worldwide operations, oversee its strategic modernization, and lead foreign intelligence collection, all source analysis, covert action, counterintelligence, and foreign liaison relationships. Each panelist will have 5 minutes to make remarks. And following all presentations, the panelists will answer questions from the audience, and I'll be moderating this panel. Over to you, Jonathan.
Am I on now? I'm on now. Okay. All right. Thank you. I've been asked to make a few comments on the experiences that we have had, the United States in particular has had, in periodic negotiations with North Korea, and what lessons derived from that experience would or would not instruct us if, under some hypothetical future, we were enter negotiations with them yet again. This has been a very episodic process, to say the least. No American officials interacted with North Korean counterparts until the late Arnie Kanter met with a senior North Korean official in 1991. And of course, there's been since then periodic efforts to negotiate with North Korea, come to understandings, most of them, of course, reflecting the question of the status of the nuclear weapons program. And a cynical observation might be that negotiations can work with North Korea until they no longer work. And the question would be is what drives that process where there seems to be at various moments in time a degree of forward movement until the process comes to a halt? And there are multiple examples of this. Two or three things bear on this. One is that it may be that at the end of the day, the North Korean elites or those responsible for the formulation of North Korean strategy really know what their red lines are, maybe better than others. In other words, things that you cannot overcome, places you cannot go, things you cannot do. Much of this, of course, historically has focused on issues of verification, related both to nuclear weapons and other capabilities. And that's been a persistent problem going back to the time that Hans Blix first entered North Korea for the International Atomic Energy Agency in the early 1990s. So if we look at that as a relevant guide, we can ask, what is it that denies the possibility for going beyond? Is it simply a question of what you are trying to hide? Is it a question of a profound distrust that exists? Let's remember that North Korea, under Kim Il-sung, when Kim Il-sung in 1957, he made a request of Mao Zedong, and he asked for all remaining Chinese personnel, military personnel and government, you know, and other kinds of economic personnel alike, to be withdrawn from North Korea. And they were. Mao honored that agreement. That was in October of 1958. And it is my argument that there has been no sustained, meaningful foreign presence of any country in North Korea now for 60 years. I dare say that's part of the secret of what I will advisedly call North Korea's success. If the question here is simply the capacity to deny external influence into the system with all the unpredictable consequences that could ensue. Now, we can say that from the point of view of the United States, negotiations do indeed at times buy time. Although we could ask, time for what? This is something that I know some of the people in the audience here have grappled with in their own experiences. But what we see at present, I think, is that there's a new context. The context here are the heightened risks of military conflict that are all too evident, at least in public chatter. Whether that reflects the realities behind the scenes, we don't know. It also bears consideration that all these negotiations have been with a remarkably small number of individuals in the North. So in some sense, when we have negotiated successfully or not with North Korea, there's the question of how representative are these individuals. They come mainly, of course, from the foreign ministry, but the access into the, dare I call it, the North Korean deep state is much more problematic. And that is what has stymied us at regular intervals in dealing with the North. I don't want to, there's not time to go through all the historical episodes, but it's striking to me nonetheless that at different critical junctures, when the door has opened to possibilities, and I, for example, if we think back to the very end of the George W. Bush administration, the Bush administration was prepared to make concessions of an extraordinary sort to North Korea. I mean, we understand this to some extent from the historical record. Some have written about it. But at that very moment, North Korea balked. Curiously enough, this coincides with the period where Kim Jong-il was in extraordinarily problematic health. He had had a stroke in 2008. And essentially, these conditions, except for that time early in the Obama administration, when the president certainly tried to see where there was negotiation possible with North Korea, it's been pretty much shut down ever since. And we can ask questions why. It does coincide then with the ascendance of Kim Jong-un. We have to ask and reflect about this as we now approach this new period of time where there are certainly many voices claiming we should be negotiating with the North, or at least talking to the North. We ought to be asking ourselves, what is it that we expect to be an outcome from there? Do we even know exactly what it is we would want from this process, and what kinds of guarantees would there be? So I look at this, given this problematic record, and it's one of the things that makes me rather cautionary about what the possibilities would be here, even as we confront the new realities of a now much more nuclear-armed state. Does North Korea really seek a negotiation here, and toward what end? Those are questions I think we ought to be asking ourselves. We ought to look before we leap, and that may be certainly preferable to something that induces a major crisis. But we have to examine these historical cases very, very carefully, lest we overinvest in that process when the results have proven so, shall we say, spotty. I think I'll end there and welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnson.
Thank you very much. Just to introduce myself, I was a former Washington Post reporter. I spent a lot of my career covering the collapse of communism. I was in Russia when the system collapsed. And when I came back, I wanted to write about Cold War, the course of the Cold War. I wrote a book called 1 Minute to Midnight, which was about the peak of the Cold War, the most dangerous moments in the Cold War. And I'd like to share some of my conclusions in researching and writing that book, which may resonate with you as we think about the risks that we're running with North Korea. My number one conclusion is that the real danger of war in October 1962 came not from the conscious decisions and actions of the three key players, Khrushchev, Kennedy, and Castro, but from miscommunications, misunderstandings, and mistakes at all levels, not only of the leaders, but also lower down the chains of command. The most famous book about the Cuban Missile Crisis is probably Essence of Decision by Graham Allison, in which he talks about the rational actor model as he described it. When I did my research, what really struck me was not the rational actor, but the irrational actor. And by irrational actor, I don't mean only the irrational leaders, but irrational actors at a much lower level. And this is exemplified for me, the kind of risk we ran is exemplified for me by a story of something, an incident on October 27th, 1962, which is probably the most dangerous day of the missile crisis. It was called Black Saturday, when there was a U-2 was shot down over Cuba. The Strategic Air Command got to DEFCON 2. And at that precise moment, in a completely unrelated incident, a U-2 stationed in Alaska flies to the North Pole to conduct a air sampling mission, atomic air sampling mission, and by mistake takes a wrong turn over the North Pole, and instead of coming back to Alaska, ends up over the Chukotka Peninsula on the most dangerous day of the Cold War. The Soviets send up MiG fighters to try to get it down. Plane runs out of fuel over the Chukotka Peninsula, miraculously makes it back to Alaska, and JFK says, "There's always some son of a bitch that doesn't get the word." And that, to me, some son of a bitch, we can imagine that kind of incident happening in the case of North Korea. Second lesson, the key role that is played by a president that nobody else can play. We hear a lot today about all these wise people surrounding the president, but if you study the XCOM meetings in October 1962, in many cases, or in several key moments, it was one man against the rest of the XCOM, and decisions were taken by a minority of one. It was only one person in that room, in the cabinet room of the White House, who had the broader view. He was not just interested in his department or how we would defend NATO. He was answerable not only to Americans, but also to future generations, and that was JFK. He also happened to understand the risks that I talked about, the risk of an accidental nuclear war. He had had experience in World War II himself. His brother had been killed in World War II, and in this he shared something with the leader of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, who had also gone through World War II. Third lesson. It helps when this president has a sense of history. JFK had, just shortly before the missile crisis, he'd read a book called The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, which deals with the origins of the First World War. And that book was very much on his mind in the way he approached the missile crisis. He kept on asking himself, you know, in 1914, the world stumbled into war without anybody really knowing the reason why. And that if we were going to get into a war in October 1962, Kennedy wanted to know the reason why. And he kept on asking that question. And although history never repeats itself exactly, there are lessons to be drawn from history. And Kennedy, both because he had experienced history himself as a soldier in World War, in war, but also because he had made a study of history, he was well placed to answer that kind of questions. Lesson number four. What we conventionally think about of military superiority has very little meaning in the nuclear age. In 1962, the United States had overwhelming nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union by numerical figures, you know, four or five times as many U.S. missiles could hit the Soviet territory as vice versa. And the qualitative difference was even greater. But this meant very little to JFK. During the crisis, he asked two most very important questions. First of all, he said, when they were considering an airstrike over Cuba, airstrikes over Cuba to take out the missile sites, he said to the commander of the Tactical Air Command, "Can we get all the missile sites that we've identified, all the missiles that exist in Cuba?" And the answer was, "We think so, Mr. President, but we can't absolutely be sure." That was a very sobering answer for JFK. And the other question that JFK asked was, what happens if even one of those missiles hits the United States? And the answer was, well, perhaps 500,000, 600,000 Americans might be killed. And Kennedy said, well, that's more than the number of Americans who died in the entire Civil War. That was unacceptable to him. And he later said that, you know, despite the military superiority that we enjoyed over the Soviet Union, Khrushchev had sufficient deterrent to prevent Kennedy from thinking about a first nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. Fifth lesson, we've heard a lot about the madman card. The madman card is really a weapon of the weak against the strong. And in the missile crisis, the madman card was played by Fidel Castro. The slogan of the Cuban Revolution is Patria o Muerte, fatherland or death. And the ability to use the madman card effectively depends on whether you can convey that you really are suicidal. And it's difficult for the president of the richest country, most powerful country in the world, to do that, because powerful countries have more to lose than poor, relatively powerless countries. So be careful how you use the madman card. Lesson number six, danger of red lines. Kennedy had drawn a red line about Soviets sending offensive weapons to Cuba, and he later came to regret that because he discovered that it boxed him in. Final lesson, the lack of knowledge about the other side. When I researched the crisis, and now it's possible to gain access pretty much to all U.S. intelligence material of the intelligence gathering of the crisis, the raw intelligence gathering. And there are many things that we did know, including the location of the sites, but there were many things that the CIA was unable to tell Kennedy. They didn't know about the number of Soviet troops in Cuba. They told him that there were 7,000 or 8,000 Soviet troops. There were 42,000 Soviet troops. He kept on asking about the location of the warheads. We knew where the missile sites were, but we didn't know where the nuclear warheads were. We only found that out about that many years later. They didn't know about the presence of tactical nuclear weapons on Cuba. They didn't know about the Soviet plans to destroy Guantanamo in the event of a U.S. invasion of Cuba. And probably the biggest unknown was the intentions of the other side. They didn't know why, they misunderstood why the reasons why Khrushchev had sent missiles to Cuba in the first place. They thought it was about something about the balance of power, when it was actually more to do with defending the Cuban Revolution. So there was a lot they didn't know. Now, the real question in the Cuban Missile Crisis was whether rational actors can impose their will on the irrational ones. And by the rational actors, in the case of the crisis, I mean Kennedy and Khrushchev. They ended up actually pretty much on the same side against the irrational actor, the man who was playing the madman card, Fidel Castro. They decided that that the risk of escalation was too great and the crisis had to be brought to an end somehow, which is why Kennedy sent his brother Robert to the Soviet embassy in Washington on the night of October 27th. And they jointly brought an end to the crisis. Now, in the North Korea crisis, you have three sides as well: United States, North Korea, and China. But the configuration is very different. We don't know who the rational actors are and who are the irrational ones. So those are my lessons. Thank you.
Thank you. I had the privilege of working with... Hello? Okay, cool. He was cutting me off before I said I had the privilege of working with him. He was always fiddling with my microphones. With David Cohen and others here, including Abril, who we'll hear from later, on a range of different issues, among them, of course, the North Korea issue, but also what I've come here today to talk about, which is lessons from the Iran nuclear diplomacy that could potentially be relevant for what is a significantly different context, but obviously there are some clear parallels. And I guess I would start by saying that if you work hard, this is to the future negotiator of the North Korean nuclear deal, that if you work hard and you produce the deal, you too can wait with bated breath about whether a future president will ultimately walk away from it, as we're doing this week with the Iran nuclear deal. That was meant as a joke, kind of, I don't know. Although it's not really a laughing matter. You know, the first thing that strikes me about the nuclear diplomacy with Iran, and I was involved in the initial establishment of the discrete channel in Oman that led to the interim deal and ultimately paved the way for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is that while we spent hours, days, weeks, years in the room with the Iranians and with our negotiating partners, most of the negotiations were shaped by activities that took place outside of the negotiating room. And the nature of U.S. strategy towards Iran and the Obama administration was I think, a remarkably singular whole-of-government approach that was multidimensional, that was the president's top priority, that was driven by the National Security Advisor, bought into by all of the principals, and executed up and down the government. So whether you're talking about sanctions, which David will get into, intelligence-led activities, force posture, alliance coordination, diplomatic options, Tom Donilon and Susan Rice put enormous attention and effort into running a whole-of-government operation to shape the overall environment and ultimately to shape Iran's choices. And as I look at the way that North Korea policy has been conducted thus far over the course of the past few months, of course, from the outside, you can't see everything. But I think this administration could learn lessons from the op tempo, the intensity, and the interdisciplinary nature of the strategy that the Obama administration pulled together that ultimately created the conditions under which you could have successful diplomacy. It's interesting that at this point it always seemed clear that the Iranians would be prepared to put on the table their nuclear program and, you know, reach a deal that involves some pretty severe restraints. But in the early years of the Obama administration, in dealing with the Ahmadinejad government, even in the P5+1 process, their notion of what a nuclear deal would look like wasn't even in the same sport, let alone the same ballpark, as what was ultimately required and ultimately produced. They were not thinking by any means of reducing the number of centrifuges or dealing with their plutonium reactor or dramatically expanding inspections. So there had to be steps taken, and economic pressure was a central part of it, to change their calculus as to what they were going to have to put on the table and ultimately deal with. And that leads me to the second lesson, which is about leverage. You know, obviously, we sought to build up leverage that we could then convert into diplomatic results at the negotiating table. And a core part of that leverage was this global sanctions regime that we built and then carefully tended. And I'm not going to go into detail on this because David can speak about it with much greater authority and specificity. But I would say that we did rely on two factors of the Iranian economy in building this leverage. The first is that it was relatively exposed to the international community, and part of what we accomplished was reducing their oil exports from 2.5 million barrels a day to 1 million barrels a day, which had a dramatic impact on their economy, and of course freezing their assets, which were being held overseas, both in connection with oil exports and other exports of the Iranian economy. So this was an exposed economy, and not just exposed in one place, but in Europe, in China, in Japan, in Korea, in South Africa, in India, and other places. The situation with North Korea is somewhat different, as David will get into. They are exposed, but they're basically exposed to one country, China, where they do 85 to 90% of their trade. So it creates a different set of calculations, but fundamentally figuring out where that exposure is and how to attack it is a critical part of building the economic leverage. The second is that we recognized that in Iran's case, they had to be at least somewhat responsive to their population, to a sense of economic dislocation and disempowerment among the Iranian population that mattered from the point of view of regime stability over time. They cared about discontent in the street. They worried about how to create outlets for pressure. And ultimately, Rouhani's election in 2013 was about a response to the economic hardship that had been imposed over the course of several years of growing sanctions against Iran. The question is North Korea similarly responsive? I think we heard from the earlier panel, and we can assess certainly not in the same way that Iran is. And so the power to withstand economic pressure, even if you can crank it up via the route of China, may be different in the North Korea case than in the Iran case. One of the things that doesn't get talked about as much in the overall strategy towards Iran was the credible threat of military force. And it came into play, I think, in two important respects. The first is that the credible threat of military force, whether by the Israelis or by the Americans, had an impact on the rest of the world agreeing to forego some of their own economic benefits from trading with Iran and signing up to the global sanctions. When Secretary Clinton and others were going around the world basically building this coalition, when David would show up in capitals around the world, one of the things that they could credibly say was, if we don't figure out a diplomatic solution that we will arrive at through the application of economic pressure, we may end up in a circumstance where either the Israelis take a strike or the United States has no choice but to take a strike. That had a meaningful impact on people signing up to this global campaign of economic pressure. Similarly, the possibility that Iran would face a military action, I think, had a meaningful impact on their own capability clock, on the speed with which they were prepared to advance their program. And they were careful not to move too far too fast, because they didn't want to take some kind of precipitous step forward that might trigger a military response. So I think it had some deterrent effect on the Iranians as well. And that is important because, as David knows better than anyone, sanctions are not a fast-moving tool. And so slowing the capability clock was important to give time and space for the sanctions to be able to work effectively in the Iran context. And you know, we knew that we could, in fact, pursue a credible threat of military force because, first, we had a good sense of where the major Iranian nuclear facilities were. Query whether that's the case with respect to the broader nuclear complex in North Korea. And second, we did not have to worry about the level of catastrophe that would be present in terms of a North Korean response against Seoul or otherwise. Obviously, Iran would have some capability to respond to an attack, but a much more limited capability given their place in the neighborhood, what they possessed, and what we and our partners could respond with. And so that threat had a level of credibility that query whether the same is present in the North Korea context. We've heard, I think, over the course of today, and many people in this room know from, you know, their own independent analysis, that Kim Jong-un doesn't look like he's in much of a mood right now to get involved in a meaningful negotiation. And so lessons about the precise parameters of a negotiation and so forth may not be all that relevant. But what I will say is that having a dedicated bilateral channel that is discreet, that is hidden from view, was a central feature of our being able to reach a successful outcome with Iran. If this had simply been done through the P5 plus one process or through a six-party talk process as the analog in North Korea, I don't think we would ever have reached the outcome we reached. We needed a dedicated space to have the conversation, to make the trade-offs, to table the proposals. And I think the same thing would hold true in the context with North Korea. And I know that over the course of years, we've tried to think about ways to maintain some contact with the North Koreans privately, discreetly, quietly, building those channels, those contacts up into something that looks more like a negotiation over time is something that, you know, we've got to try to stick with, even if the odds seem incredibly long at the moment, because any successful negotiation will emanate from that kind of channel to a greater extent than some public formal set of negotiations. The final thing that I would say is that all of the major powers of the world, in the case of Iran, were united on one side of the negotiating table with Iran on the other side of the negotiating table. And what was interesting about that was it took a certain number of chairs to actually seat all of the P5 plus one representatives, because you had the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany plus the EU. That's a bunch of people. The Iranians insisted on an identical number of seats on their side of the table and had to go find bodies, their drivers and so forth, to fill them. But this was a negotiation set up with the world on one side and Iran on the other side. One of the interesting dynamics in the North Korea negotiation, and Michael referred to this, is a three-sided negotiation. That the Chinese, it's not the US and China and the rest of the world on one side of the table and North Korea on the other side of the table. That is part of the challenge. Now, there's a reason for that related to China and North Korea's unique historical relationship, but I think part of the long-term diplomatic strategy cannot just be about going after the Chinese on more pressure to set up a U.S.-North Korea negotiation. It should be to shift the Chinese orientation so they feel some responsibility as a regional power, as a player with global responsibilities, to actually fulfill the North Korean paranoia we heard about on the panel before, that now they, North Korea, in a sense, has to shift from being their client or someone where they're the broker between the U.S. on one hand and North Korea on the other hand, to being a problem they need to help solve. I don't think that that kind of adjustment is going to happen in the near term, but I think there are seeds that have been planted to that effect within the psychology of some of the leaders in China, and that this has to be a shift that we have to push for over time, because as long as we remain in this three-sided negotiation, I think our capacity to be able to effectively shape the environment and shape the North Koreans' calculus will be inhibited, and we will not be able to make the same kind of progress we were able to make with Iran. So those are some thoughts from the Iran experience that may prove useful if ever we do get back to the table with North Korea.
So thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
It is on. Thank you.
And it's great to work with Jake. Here it was great to work with Jake and in this Iran deal with Avril and with the whole team. So as Young mentioned, I was most recently the deputy director of the CIA. Before that, I was the undersecretary of Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, which is a mouthful of a title, but basically I got to oversee all of our sanctions efforts, including the sanctions that that Jake was referencing, that built up over time, creating the leverage for the Iran negotiations, also the North Korea sanctions, Russia sanctions, what have you. So my comments this morning are going to be focused on the role of sanctions historically and how they can be a part of the effort going forward with North Korea. So first, I think it's important to recognize that sanctions can serve three purposes and possibly a fourth. The three, which I think are familiar to most, is number one, you know, sanctions are essential to reinforce international law, essentially. And, you know, in a series of Security Council resolutions, whether you're talking about Iran or North Korea, the Security Council has made clear that the testing, the development of a nuclear program is unlawful. Security Council has demanded that North Korea returns the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so following through on sanctions is a way of putting some reinforcement in that international law obligation on North Korea. Secondly, sanctions can impede progress, particularly targeted sanctions that are aimed at those entities both inside a country and outside the country that are essential for helping to develop the nuclear program, the ballistic missile program. And so in the Iran context, We spent a lot of time over many years identifying the brokers, identifying the businesses, identifying those actors outside of Iran who were providing essential ingredients to the Iranian nuclear program and its ballistic missile program. That is still going on, I should note, with respect to the ballistic missile program. Frankly, it's a part of also the deal to keep an eye on that for the nuclear program. In North Korea, the same thing. We are, have been and are continuing to focus on those external actors that support the North Korean program, both by going after the financial institutions and the businesses that are supplying material, as well as trying to take out of international commerce by designations the North Korean entities. That's not going to stop the program. It didn't stop Iran's program. It won't stop North Korea's program, but it does impede progress. It does create time and space for other efforts to proceed. The third objective of sanctions is to create leverage. As Jake noted, the effort in Iran to ramp up the sanctions over time and to move from these targeted sanctions that impede the program to much more broad-based sanctions that really took a toll on the Iranian economy. That created important leverage and, frankly, trade currency for the deal. And Jay can speak to this as he was involved in the discrete channel in these negotiations. But the Iranians were, as Jake noted, not that interested in negotiations for a long time. And we were talking, I don't know if we were talking or negotiating or somewhere in between for some period of time. But it wasn't until the fall of 2013 when the Iranian rial basically fell off a cliff because of the oil sanctions had been put in place, because of the additional sanctions that we put in place to essentially deprive Iran of access to the revenue that it was earning from the reduced oil sales that it was able to make. That's when the Iranians became serious about the negotiations. That sort of leverage can be created by sanctions. The fourth way in which sanctions can be useful, and I say can be because I think this is a debatable point, but it's important to think about, is to foment unrest internally in a country. As Jake noted, the Iranians were concerned about the street, were concerned about losing control of their population. That created some leverage for the negotiations, but there was also a theory that had we continued with the sanctions and even ramped them up further, that it could have created the conditions for some internal efforts to oust the regime. And I think in North Korea, the last panel was talking about the role of the elites and how Kim Jong-un is able to keep the elites on side. I think there is a question that's worth talking about whether a significantly torqued up sanctions program that deprives North Korea and deprives Kim Jong-un of the ability to buy off the elites and makes the elites feel that their little hold on a decent life in North Korea as they look around the rest of the country and realize that that everyone else is living in great deprivation, that is at risk if the nuclear program, ballistic missile program, continues. And sanctions, particularly really intensive sanctions, I think can, at least theoretically, play into that. At a minimum, it creates additional leverage. I would say, the second point, that I think that the Trump administration has taken some important steps to create the leverage that might be necessary to get a good negotiation going. I was frequently at events like this would say, going back, 6 9 months ago, that the idea that North Korea was sanctioned out or that sanctions won't work on North Korea was wrong. it was in fact the case that we had a much less intensive sanctions program focused on North Korea than we had had on Iran, or for that matter, on many other of our sanctions targets for many years. Even as we were ramping up our sanctions on North Korea, it still hadn't reached anywhere close to the level that we had with Iran. I think that is no longer the case. And I would just cite a couple of things here. The Security Council resolution from over the summer that took aim at North Korea's ability to export coal, that will take off about $1 billion of North Korean revenue. And now, mind you, the North Korean economy is about the size of Dayton, Ohio's economy, just by analogy. It's about a $4 or $5 billion economy. You take off $1 billion of their revenue, that's a significant impact. The second really important step was the executive order that was issued last month in the middle of September that wasn't the first foray into secondary sanctions, but was a really significant step up of the secondary sanctions aimed at North Korea. And what this executive order did was, through the threat of cutting off financial institutions that trade with North Korea in any goods, it doesn't have to be in illicit goods, doesn't have to be in something for the nuclear program, the ballistic missile program, but any trade with North Korea that any financial institution facilitates, that financial institution can be cut off from the U.S. That is an extraordinarily powerful secondary sanctions tool. It is essentially imposing a worldwide trade embargo on North Korea. Because any bank that wants to be able to operate internationally needs to have access to the U.S. financial system. If that bank, any bank, helps facilitate either an import or export, significant import or export into North Korea, they can be cut off from the U.S. That is a powerful, powerful tool, and I think over time we will see having a real impact on North Korea. The other part of this that the Trump administration has taken on is to try to change the Chinese calculus. So over the summer, there was an action taken against a bank called the Bank of Dandong in China, which had been facilitating a fair amount of economic activity with North Korea. And that was a shot across the bow to China, saying we are prepared to put at risk your financial institutions if you don't, sort of come on side on this three-part, three-dimensional negotiation, come over to our side a little bit in the effort with North Korea. And then again, this executive order, by targeting financial institutions anywhere that facilitate trade, given that about 90% of all of North Korea's trade goes through China, it is effectively another sort of warning shot at China that their financial institutions are at risk. And you can see the Chinese recognize that, because at the same time that we announced this executive order, the Chinese central bank sent out notice to their financial institutions telling them to draw down their accounts with North Korea and not to take on any new North Korean accounts. They're trying to protect their financial institutions from the threat that they will be targeted by the U.S. So the final two points I will make very quickly are, number one, sanctions take time to work. We have an impatience here. I think you can see this in some of the president's tweets, that this problem needs to get solved immediately. Sanctions won't solve this problem immediately. They take time to have an effect, and the steps that have been taken over the last 6 months or so to increase the pressure, that will manifest over a couple of years. And that was our experience in Iran. It took some time for the efforts going after their oil, going after their access to their revenue, for the Iranians to really become serious about negotiations, and frankly for the effect on the economy in Iran to take hold. The same is true with North Korea. Excuse me. And the final point is that sanctions are not a policy. Sanctions are a tool of a broader policy effort. As as Jake was saying, a whole of government effort was necessary in Iran. The same is true in North Korea. I think you see some disconnect currently in the administration on this point. You see Secretary Mnuchin, Secretary Mattis, Secretary Tillerson talking about the importance of negotiations, the importance of imposing pressure on North Korea to try to induce a negotiation. You have a president who is tweeting that all these efforts are futile. I think that policy disconnect is a real problem, because sanctions to work need to be embedded in a broader policy construct. And without that, without there being that broader policy construct, it's just punitive action without any, I think, real prospect of success.
We're going to open up to questions. I was thinking about, but let me start off by saying thank you for those comments from all of you. Michael Dobbs, I was thinking about something from your book where you say communism was not defeated militarily, it was defeated economically, culturally, and ideologically. I thought of that quote when Jake was also talking about creating the space, and David was also talking about creating the space and creating the leverage. So I wondered if you think that the idea of maximum pressure and engagement should be flipped around, creating the space, or do you have any thoughts about the sequencing of the types of activities that need to be undertaken, or the conditions that need to be created for negotiations on anything to happen?
Well, from the point of view of someone who did see the communist system collapse in the country of its origin, I do think that, this is a larger analysis, but I think the basic reason for the collapse of communism were the internal weaknesses and contradictions in the system itself, rather than the pressure that was applied from outside. In fact, I think that the Cuban Missile Crisis was probably the last moment in the Cold War when anybody really thought seriously of the possibility of a military victory over the Soviet Union. And that was, in a way, liberating, because it excluded the military solution from the equation. We had to find other ways to undermine communism in the Soviet Union, including engagement, which proved over time, of course it took a long time, it's like sanctions, but it took even longer time, but that proved very effective. But it took a generation. And this was Kennan's strategy back in 1948 with containment, that identifying and gradually exploiting over many, many years the weaknesses in the system, and that was the strategy that was finally adopted towards the Soviet Union, and I think is the only strategy that has a chance of working with North Korea if you take the military solution off the table.
We'll take three at a time as we did last time. So back there, in the middle, and then Patricia.
Stanley Roth, still retired. Two questions, one for the panelists. I think all of you mentioned possibilities with some skepticism about three-party negotiations and who's on what side. But I don't think, and I could be wrong, any of you mentioned South Korea. Can one really have negotiations on the fate of South Korea without South Korea on the table? Second question, a little unusually, is for the moderator. Going back to the last panel, who is Kim Jong-un. We didn't talk about some of the lesser sanctions that strike me as quite interesting, meaning the international isolation, closing of embassies, sending home of workers, shutting down small trade in a lot of different countries. I'm not sure if any of the North Korean restaurants have been shut yet. But in other words, it seems the Trump administration is having increasing success in global isolation, detached from the U.S., China, and some of the sanctions that David talked about. How, if at all, does that affect Kim, the fact that there is a more global isolation closer to a pariah regime? Does it maybe push him toward negotiations, or the opposite, push him to dig in more?
Hi, Patricia Kim, Council on Foreign Relations. As Jake mentioned in the panel, the Trump administration's handling of the Iran deal has real implications for dealing with North Korea. So I'd like to ask, how can the U.S. government persuade North Korea and China that any deal we strike, assuming we can get to the table at some point, will be honored by successive U.S. administrations? Are there measures that our government can take to restore our credibility as a good negotiating partner?
My name is Takahiro Mota. I'm a visiting fellow at CSS Japan. My question goes to David. You mentioned lastly that sanctions took time. I'd like to ask you, how long would it take? Do you think it would work in time before North Korea has the capability to be able to attack here? Thank you.
Four questions: global isolation, the role of South Korea, how to persuade that the U.S. is credible if we enter negotiations, and the last one: how long will it take?
Let me proceed in violent agreement with Stanley Roth that this is, after all, the Korean Peninsula, and in addition, we have the immediate proximity of Japan as a second core American ally. Too much of this discussion goes on almost oblivious to this larger context. And very frankly, you're not going to get a credible outcome. Recognizing the odds on a credible outcome are very, very problematic if you, in some sense, have South Korea absented from this process, or Japan. And I must say, Stanley, that and here, speaking to some of the issues were raised by the other panelists, one of the successes, if you will, of the Trump administration has been that whether it's because others are wary of exactly what the United States might do or God knows what, but you have all of them, including China, increasingly singing more from a common sheet of music. There doesn't seem to be, in my view at least, there is a belief to use various kinds of tools such as sanctions in a much more active way against North Korea. And that, frankly, I'm not going to get into the realm of predictions, but I think in a lot of respects, the economic bite on this will, with time, be very, very significant. It's just simply the question of the timeline of this relative to the other kinds of things that the United States and others worry about with respect to the operationalization of a nuclear weapons capability of a long range. And those are the two things. But it does highlight the vulnerabilities that I think are there, but also the protecting of the core equities of American allies, first and foremost, the Republic of Korea.
Just on that point, when I referred to the unique role of China, I wasn't suggesting there be three-party talks between the U.S., China, and North Korea, only that China joined the same side of the table, in a sense, as the Japanese, the Koreans, and the Americans are on. So, of course, Japan and Korea should be central to this. I would note, as an interesting lesson from the Iran talks, is when we were running the secret channel in Oman, we were not consulting with either Israel, our Gulf partners, or for that matter, in a direct way with our other P5+1 partners. That caused friction over time. It was a challenge for us, and it was a trade-off between being able to ensure discretion and secrecy on the one hand, while on the other hand, recognizing that our important allies and partners had equities that we had to take into account. And of course, we didn't produce a final deal without that consultation, but it was something we were very mindful of. So the point I was trying to make on China has more to do with the unique role they play in this context that was not present in the Iran context. I think if you constituted a P5+1 today and started an Iran nuclear negotiation, the Russians would actually look more like China does in the North Korea context. They wouldn't just be one of the team
They would think of themselves having to balance equities vis-a-vis Iran and the United States in a different way. And focusing on that dimension for me is quite intriguing. And I was interested in what Jonathan just said, that the Chinese approach to this may be shifting more quickly than maybe I have perceived so far. On the issue of the interaction or interplay between Iran and the Iran nuclear deal and potential diplomacy with North Korea, I think the premise of the question is very sound, which is if the United States makes a deal with a nuclear aspirant and says, we're prepared to do certain things if you accept certain restraints, and then walks away from it, it definitely directly undermines our credibility, both with respect to other nuclear aspirants or countries seeking to advance their nuclear capabilities, and with our negotiating partners who were asking both to join us at the table and to join us in continuing economic pressure that comes at some cost to them. So there's no doubt in my mind, and it doesn't take leaps of logic to see the ways in which the harm would accrue from walking away from or calling into question the Iranian nuclear deal on any future effort to bring about a stable negotiated solution to the North Korean nuclear question. I would just underscore that there's an even more fundamental issue at play here, which is we have a nuclear crisis that we are spending this morning talking about, the North Korean nuclear crisis. Why would we want to add a second nuclear crisis other than to employ a similar group of think tank people to have a conference maybe tomorrow on how we have terrible options with Iran because we don't have the possibility of a negotiated solution, so what the heck are we going to do? And so I think particularly as we try to grapple with this crisis, raising questions about our staying power with respect to the Iran deal is not, it doesn't just defy strategic logic, it defies simple common sense.
So let me try and tie together three different questions into one answer, which is that the North Korean economy is vulnerable. So I mean, Jake made the point that one of the advantages we had in the Iran context was Iran was out in the world. And so there were a lot of places where we could squeeze the Iranians in various ways, and we took advantage of that, took a lot of work, a lot of travel around the world. But we got the Indians and the South Koreans and the Europeans on board, what have you. North Korea is quite different. It is obviously highly concentrated in China. But there are also these other places around the world, and this gets to the question of this pressure campaign that frankly the Trump administration has continued what we were doing in the Obama administration, I think is really important, is to go out and to cut off these little fountains of funds that go back to North Korea. They are important because the North Korean economy is so small and Kim Jong-un's need for foreign currency is so intense. He needs foreign currency to buy what they need to import and to buy off the elites. He can't use the Korean won, the North Korean won, to buy anything. He needs foreign currency. And so if you go after their ability to earn foreign currency overseas, including through what they do in their embassies to essentially run little mini trading posts out of their embassies, it makes a difference back in North Korea. So there is a vulnerability in the North Korean economy that we can target both with these broad-based sanctions, but also on these more targeted sanctions going after their financial networks around the world. Related to that, though, is the point that Jake was just making. We need our allies to work with us on this effort. We need China in particular, but we need others around the world, the same as we needed them in the Iran context. For them to do that, they need to bear cost. It is painful in some respect, particularly for China, to change its approach to North Korea and to put pressure on the North Koreans. If they wanted to do it, if it was painless, they would have done it a long time ago. To get the Chinese on board with this, in the same way we got the international community on board with Iran, we need to be able to tell them that there is a better outcome, that we are actually serious about a negotiated resolution here. If they don't believe that, the Chinese in particular don't believe that we're interested in negotiation in North Korea, it's going to be that much harder to get them to bear the cost of putting pressure on the North Koreans. And that is one of the real dangers of backing out of the Iran deal, is that we will be unable to credibly tell the Chinese and others around the world that they should bear this cost, because we are actually interested in a non-military solution to the North Korean nuclear problem.
I'm Bob Einhorn from Brookings. As Jake and David have pointed out, the Obama administration succeeded in imposing devastating economic sanctions against Iran. That provided great leverage for the Iran nuclear deal, but apparently not sufficient leverage to achieve U.S. maximum negotiating goals, including in particular a complete ban on uranium enrichment in Iran. And the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, has a wide range of compromises. I think they were necessary compromises to make, but compromises. David has pointed out how the Trump administration has succeeded in ramping up pressures against North Korea, and I agree, they're very, very impressive and potentially important tools. And this will provide more leverage. But how much leverage to achieve what objectives in the negotiation? The current objective is to put irresistible pressure on North Korea to the point where Kim Jong-un agrees to abandon his nuclear and missile programs completely and in the near future. Is that achievable? I don't think that's achievable. And if it's not achievable, with all the leverage we're able to amass, what, you know, should we fall back to interim limits, a phased approach to denuclearization, or is that too politically risky and we should simply fall back to a long-term strategy of deterrence, pressure, and containment?
Thank you. It's very interesting. Could it be said that I'm a student? Could it be said that Israel pre-67, where it was very economically weak, could be comparable to North Korea, for it got its nuclear weapons and was able to hold itself back even through conventional means, but still had the backbone of those nuclear weapons, and it succeeded. So the North Koreans could also make that bet.
Alex Augustine, I have a question regarding, we talked about with the sanctions program, a not insignificant aspect of the program is the hope that the effect on the populace will be to foment unrest with the government. We talked about that in the context of Iran, and also hopefully that may or may not work in North Korea, given the recent EO concerning a much broader-based sanctions program. But with Korea, I'm curious, because North Korea emphasizes this enmity with the United States, and that's something that's built into the culture of North Korea and the North Korean populace, that, you know, that the United States is the enemy, North Korea is a victim of the United States aggression. And because the regime controls so much of the information that the population has access to, how do you think that affects the effectiveness of a potential sanctions program in North Korea in that regard?
North Korea likes to gather enemies. They have many enemies. The United States is only one of them. In fact, at the present time, the only major power with whom North Korea interacts on any kind of semi-regular basis is Russia. They're not dealing with China. They certainly are dealing with the United States on any kind of a credible basis. And Japan's relations, although Abe at different times has flirted with the idea of trying to resume the return of the other abductees, that's pretty much shut down right now because of all of North Korea's missile and nuclear activity and direct threats to Japan. And of course, then there's South Korea that, frankly, the North Koreans have stiffed despite their incentives to do it otherwise. So, you know, it's an odd juxtaposition, but granted, naming the United States as a primary adversary, I get that. That's been a sustaining element in North Korea from their very origins. It's a threat-based system. But, you know, I think that the pressures here come from multiple channels. I mean, because there's the question of, are they really, in essence, shutting themselves off from a whole variety of perspective relationships, or because of their own wariness? I mean, very frankly, the North Koreans have openly now, in very authoritative ways, begun to talk about China as an enemy. And let's not lose sight of that. North Korean nationalism is extraordinarily intense, and it's certainly well practiced over the decades. And so that's kind of where we are at. If I could turn just to Bob's question very, very quickly. Bob, it is my reluctant conclusion that, you know, where we will be, frankly, in a way not unlike what George Kennan talked about a long time ago, is in a long-term containment and deterrence policy versus vis-a-vis North Korea. I'm not trying to compare North Korea per se as a system. It is remarkable in its own right, just given how what a modest society or regime we're talking about here. But I think that that's what we have to keep our eye on, that ball. It doesn't mean that in some context we wouldn't talk to North Korea, but I think that the first and foremost goal has to be a strategy of inhibition by all means practicable, but short of the onset of war. Now, how you juggle that and how people estimate that may vary a great deal, but I think that those are realistic and achievable goals. It's not a solution, or it's certainly not a near-term solution, but it's a very, very necessary way in which I think the United States has to protect not only its own interests, but the interests of its core allies in the region.
Just on, Bob, your question really hits, you know, it's where the rubber meets the road. And going back to the Iran context, which, of course, Bob knows well because he was a critical part of the early phases of those negotiations, we had the benefit, when you think about the clocks, the capability clock of Iran versus the sanctions clock of the United States, to have advanced the sanctions clock to the point where there was enormous pressure on Iran before their capability clock had reached a truly critical juncture. I think part of that is because they slow-walked their program for the reasons that I said, whereas North Korea has been racing forward pell-mell. And that meant that we could, in fact, do something which in the North Korea context is often maligned, and that is get a freeze. I mean, effectively what we did for a year and a half from essentially November of 2013 until July of 2015 was an interim agreement that was essentially stop things in time, and then you can get to those compromises that you ultimately talk about. That only worked because we could freeze the Iranian program because we brought enough pressure to bear at a point that we felt we could manage. The problem in the North Korea context is everything that David has talked about is going to take considerably more time, and these in the race between these two clocks, it seems very difficult to see how you amass enough pressure to produce the freeze, to produce whatever the compromises are over time, that basic equation doesn't line up as nicely in the North Korea context as it worked in the Iran context. But nonetheless, I think as an object of our strategy, we still have to work towards that for as long as we can, because I neither think that we should decide now is the time to go take some preventive military option, nor do I believe that we should say, wherever we end up at the end of the day, today our policy is now just to shift to, you know, essentially a form of acquiescence in this capability and then managing it over time. So even though I acknowledge this is
not easy to do. I think that basic logic still has to obtain. We still have to build the pressure as fast as we can in an effort to try to change the way in which these two clocks are running.
Let me just offer one quick addendum to Jake's clocks here. And that is that and this goes back to the question I didn't answer before about how long it's going to take. The clock on pressure in North Korea can actually accelerate very quickly, both in reality and in perception. The reality will take a little bit longer because just the way economies operate. But if the Chinese were to say clearly, definitively, that they were going to, say, cut off fuel oil, petroleum to North Korea, and they did it. And they got a big pipe and they got a handle on it. They turn it, they cut it off. They've done it before. They can do it again. If they were to do that, the sort of interim effect of that in North Korea, I think, would be significant. Even before you see the economic impact roll out, there is such a sort of exquisite vulnerability in North Korea to what China can do that you can accelerate this clock if you get the Chinese on board. That's obviously a big if. We've been, as a country, been working on that for quite a while. But, I think there are some, green shoots of possibility here that China may be prepared to do that, again, if they think that we are serious about a negotiated resolution. They think that what we're going to do is bomb North Korea and spark a war there. You can forget about China being of any assistance, I think.
Just a quick point to follow on David's observation. One of the vulnerabilities here is that the economy of northeastern China is, let's just not say, a stirring success. In an ironic way, there is a dependence on trade with North Korea of various kinds of commodities. And again, the Chinese here, I'm not trying to put them on a pedestal, but the decisions that they have at least announced and things they have agreed to through the Security Council resolutions and through statements of their own suggest to me that they are more prepared than in the past to bear these costs. I think that the other thing that bears some consideration is the Chinese, of course, are on the cusp of the 19th Party Congress, as I don't have to remind my good colleague Cheng Li out in the audience. Let's see also what outcomes come out of that process as well. It's not to think fancifully about this, but it's just in a very ironic kind of way, China has a vulnerability here that we tend not to weigh just simply because China seems to have this disproportionate role in the North Korean economy. One final thing, if I could, let us pay attention to Russia. It represents the possibility of a get-out-of-jail-free card. And there's been movement here by the Russians. They're trying to reactivate a whole variety of relationships. That could lead to some clever strategies that will still find North Korean resources getting out, finding their way maybe even to China and other places still. So I'm not putting, unconditional faith in the honoring of the agreements that are there. But Russia, whether diplomatically or otherwise, is a potential wild card in this situation right now.
Yeah, very briefly to expand on my earlier answers. Of course, we're preoccupied with the short-term crisis and short-term solutions, but we need not to lose sight of two things. One is the risk of uncontrollable escalation. We have to think about that and think how we're going to deal with that. That's the most worrying concern to me. I think we're in a perhaps not quite as dangerous as the Cuban Missile Crisis, but we're fast approaching that kind of risk. And secondly, I think we need to think longer term. We need to think about devising the kind of policies that ultimately enable the West to defeat Soviet totalitarianism. And this is not something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take decades, generations, but we should be investing some thought, as much thought into that as to dealing with the short-term crisis.
Speaking of the clock and the time, it's time for lunch. Please join me in thanking my esteemed colleagues and panelists over here. Thank you.